Why are so many dogs suffering from health issues? Actress Katherine Heigl, who's helped save over 16,000 dogs through her foundation, says she's seeing more issues with dogs' joints, odors, and health than ever before. And after doing a ton of research, she feels there's one place we can look to support any dog's health: their food. So she decided to create something she could actually feel good about feeding her dogs. It's called Superfood Complete. Superfood Complete is made with over 30 of the healthiest ingredients on the planet, including several superfoods vital to your dog's health. Badlands Ranch also sponsors the Jason Debus Heigl Foundation, which has helped rescue thousands of dogs and place them in loving homes. Dogs across America are trying this food and experiencing amazing health benefits. Go to badlandsranch.com/save50 and order right now to get up to 50% off your regular price order with a 90-day money-back guarantee. If you want your dog to experience all these incredible things, go to badlandsranch.com/save50 today.
This is an ad by BetterHelp. What are your self-care non-negotiables? It's hard to make time for the things that keep you healthy, but being consistent with self-care is like working a muscle. And when life gets crazy, that muscle keeps you strong. Therapy is the ultimate self-care, and BetterHelp makes it easy to get started with affordable online sessions you can do from anywhere. Never skip therapy day with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com today to get 10% off your first month.
You're listening to Power Athlete Radio, a podcast dedicated to empowering your performance every damn day. Join former NFL pro and Power Athlete founder John Wellborn as he dissects the greatest minds in strength, conditioning, and more. So whether your goal is to be the hammer, destroy mediocrity, or simply move the dirt, you've come to the right place. Now with the warm-up done, let the gains begin.
Welcome to a very special episode of Power Athlete Radio. This episode is important because we got to interview a legend and pillar in the strength game, Louis Simmons from Westside Barbell. This episode is important to me personally, as I knew Louis as a friend and mentor, having first heard his name in the infamous Westside Barbell as a 14-year-old kid reading Powerlifting USA magazines in Zangus' garage. What makes this podcast extremely impactful is the recent passing of Louis Simmons on March 24th at the tender age of 74. Anyone that knew Lou knows he lived his life with his foot firmly smashed on the skinny pedal. We are honored to have done this last interview with him in Columbus, Ohio. Thanks to Tom and the crew at Westside Barbell for making it happen. Without their help and stewardship, we would never have gotten this opportunity. So, my only advice, strap in. Hey, welcome to another episode of Power Athlete Radio. We are on location in the beautiful Columbus, Ohio, with our good friend Louis Simmons here at Westside Barbell. So, Mr. Simmons, how you doing? Good to see you again.
I'm doing great. How are you? It's been a long time.
It has. Way too long.
Yeah.
I did definitely enjoy a lot of my time here, and a lot of the stuff that I learned from you, I still put into practice daily. So, yeah, thanks for coming on Power Athlete Radio.
Yeah. Louis, thank you. We had a couple trips. I was with John 2015, but there was a first trip. I think that's an excellent way for us to start out when John first came out to Westside.
Yeah, no, it was great. At the time, I remember you called me on the phone because you were interested in putting a certification together. And you asked me if I wanted to sit on the board, for your certification. And I was, of course. And then you said, hey, why don't you come out? And I came out for a couple of weeks and got to hang out. And it was eye-opening, to say the least. Huh. Yeah, it was fun. You walk into that environment. I remember walking in the first day and it was like gangster rap at 10. I mean, dude, there was probably about 2,300 pound dudes that were probably not over 5'5". I never seen that many big dudes since I'd left the NFL. So it was definitely an exciting environment to go into.
Yeah. That environment's a lot.
Well, I'm always and I told these guys when we showed up, and Charles had never been here before, but we pull into Westside, here on Industrial. It's in an industrial complex. Mm-hmm. You walk in, it's two bays. And I think people walk in and they sometimes think, Westside Barbell, they've probably heard the legends. People always say the world famous, but I always call it the most infamous gym in the world. And it's in two bays, and you walk in and it's, packed with equipment and strongest people in the world.
Bad performance. We broke about 15 all-time world records last year. Everybody talks, but we walk. We walk it and they talk it. they got all kind of gimmicks and they never go to meets and, you know, but I don't get on the internet. I don't know.
Well, it's just a, you know, I mean, you've been dealing with hate on Westside Barbell for,
yeah,
since day one.
Yeah, no, it don't bother me. You know, there's a saying that wolves don't hear sheep cry, and I don't. So, you know, a bunch of people like that to me are just bitches, and that's all they're ever going to be. They're born that way, they're going to die that way. They say old men set in their ways. It's not really true. They're setting their ways around young men, and then they become old men. It just gets worse.
Well, I mean,
they don't want to learn.
Do you think, yeah, I mean, that's the idea, right? Like, you have to be in this constant state of growth and, mm-hmm. you know, not a fixed mindset. Right. And I think for you, I mean, you've never had a fixed mindset in that you were always constantly looking for different ways to increase performance and, you know, to kind of increase the total.
Yeah, I mean, I have 14, you know, United States and European patents. And it's all geared to either prevention of injury or making you stronger. You try our MR19 down there? It's a machine you slide up and down.
Oh, yeah. So, yeah. That thing it looked like a reverse frog squat almost.
Yeah. That thing is real. You won't believe what it will do for sprinting or lifting. It's unbelievable.
Yeah. We just had 50 pounds on there and we're still.
My girl was using 125 this morning.
I got another crack at it then.
Yeah.
She had 100 reps with no weight on it. The hardest, yeah, all the way down. But we train so much hip. A lot of hip, you know, that's all we do. Not all we do, but primarily what we do. We didn't, I don't know what you want to lead into, but we do a lot of jumps. So we're doing depth jumps off a 20-inch box, and she constantly made progress. And then we did depth jumps off of depth drops off a 60-inch box. And it would take about 2 weeks to see any improvement in the jumping. So we decided we just hit her hips. So we hit her hips for 9 weeks, and she came in, she broke her touch record by 3 inches. By not doing any jumps, by just concentrating on the muscles. That's always been my theory. Just make the muscles strong. If you're an athlete, you're an athlete. If you're not, you're not, you know.
We interrupt this episode with a shameless self-promotion. Do you want to build thick, sidewalk-splitting slabs of muscle? Let me introduce you to Jack Street. Get access to the same tried-and-true training methods I followed during my 10 years in the NFL, all to walk into training camp at 308 pounds at sub-8% body fat. Punch your ticket to the gain train and join thousands of residents already following Jack Street. Head to powerathletehq.com/Jack Street and claim your 7-day free trial today. Now back to the show. It's interesting. Like, there's so much confusion when you talk about like athletic form of training and, you know, bodybuilding, and all these people are trying to hybrid this stuff. But at the end of the day, I mean, it goes back to generating force. I remember, you know, when I, you know, walked into your place years ago and we were talking about, you know, Fred Hatfield, compensatory acceleration. I mean, I was 14 years old training at George Zangas' garage with him telling me about compensatory acceleration. The idea is mechanical advantage increases, so does bar speed. You know, like when I would go punch, try to punch 3 to 6 inches through the individual,
yep.
You know, finish everything, violent hip extension. And, you know, that was the garage I grew up in. And, you know, and I remember, I mean, I know you know the story. George had one of your first prototypes in the reverse hyper.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it was like it just seemed.
Yeah, squat suits, right?
Yeah. Yeah. It was a marathon.
Yeah, I remember.
Yeah. And we had. They were shitty.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah, they were awful. They.
It was the best at the time.
Well, they had seams. And the problem is when you put them on and you would squat, you would basically get like the skin would rip wherever the seams were. So you take your squat suit off and you fucking be bleeding.
And you're going like, did that thing give me 20 pounds?
Yeah. So that's what was so impressive when you see like Fred Hatfield squatting, what, 1,037 or something in George's suit. And he probably had 20 pounds of carryover. Yeah.
Know? Yeah. I talk about CAD a lot and compensatory acceleration training. And it in theory, it's good. But with lighter weights, you must use bands. You must accommodate resistance with it, because at the top, you're not producing any force. You know, at the end of your punch, you have zero. In Olympic lifting, the force is diminished from the first pull. At the second pull, the bar slows down to zero, and that's where it has the least amount of force. You know, that's a tricky sport. You know, it looks different, and it's not really cracked up what it's supposed to be.
Yeah. Well, the accommodating resistance, was really interesting because as you got stronger, I mean, teaching people compensatory acceleration only takes them so far. Like once you get to a point, you have to use accommodating resistance.
Right, exactly.
So that as you're speeding it up, you actually have some form of force. And like, you know, using the bands and the chains, you know.
Yeah, and the bands were so good over chains because it produced the overspeed eccentrics and was for greater stretch reflex. The Dr. Siff, when he was alive, you know, I did seminars with him. And I had him convinced that I could override the goat tendon by using an enormous amount of band. And because, you know, you take weights, you get crushed in the bottom sometimes, right? Mm-hmm. None of my guys have ever got crushed with bands, you know, bands and weights. You know, at least, I mean, they hardly ever miss, but I've never seen them not start back up. It's an opposite and equal effect. Mm-hmm. If you put like 700 pound of band on there, you're going to exert immediately, your body will want to resist to that. Back in the opposite direction. And he died. And I've never got anyone to come here and test any of the things I do. And I've done a lot that they've never done.
Do you think that obviously the bands are dramatically better than the chains, or do the chains have a place in the whole hierarchy?
Bands, I like chains. A band, you know, no matter what, a band is so much for you, any kind of band, so much for me. But me and you could never train together because all the chain would be on the ground when I sit down. That's one problem. You know, it's too unregulated. Bands doesn't matter. They're constant. You know, light band, medium band, green band, double green bands. You know, we use a lot of band. And that's how Vocal Pool got so strong. I mean, he's got 1180 weighing 264. So it did it, but all the the heavy amount of band, super maximal at the top, over speed eccentric. So that's how we did it.
You know, I've told people for years when I came out here and we were working on my squat, you made a funny statement which I've taken. You said, "Hey, you said your waist is too small, but you also said you have good enough mobility to squat toes forward." And then when I asked you, how come all your guys are squatting with their toes out? You said, because their bellies are too fat. They can't get into the squat. But he said, you were like, hey, your mobility is good. You need to go toes forward. And I've argued with people with this for years. Like when you know, athleticism, movement, playing football. I mean, that was my whole deal where, you know, constantly working on driving toes forward, putting the big toe on the ground and being more violent. And you made a good point. You were like, you know, you should squat toes forward. Unless you can't because you're too fat, and then you got to open your toes up.
But Vocal Pool did.
Yeah, and he squatted with his toes out.
I've had a couple of guys that could do it, but I mean, I could never do it or anything. And, you know, so I'm always in arguments with football guys, for not too long, though, about squatting wide. So why would you don't play football out there? Have you ever watched the beginning of a football game when the camera's behind the punter and all the linemen got their god darn feet that wide? That's how you, the game, that's when we had three guys here at Ohio State in 3 years in a row, tear groin. They say they do all this flexibility work. I said, yeah, but you're all weak. You know, the Boza brothers and then Chase Young. Same injury. How do you get the same injury? That's not so good. Not when you're talking about what, number one or two draft pick?
Well, the where people get wrapped around the axles, they start looking at flexibility in terms of passive. And it's really active range of motion. Mm-hmm. And the only way that I found to ever really train active range of motion was under some form of heavy weight. And I explained to somebody one time, like lifting weights is like stretching with heavy ass weight on your back and being able to move through full ranges of motion under load and do it violently. Mm-hmm. Like there's no replicating that. And all the fucking rotational yoga and all the other stretching bullshit passive that you do isn't going to make you strong in those range of motions that you need it when you're most, you know, like got to generate the most force. So I'm always amazed when I watch these guys do all this stretching. And I'm like, what is passive fucking stretching doing? This episode of Power Athlete Radio is powered by Train Heroic, the most immersive strength training app experience on the market. We've built an online training business by partnering with Train Heroic to deliver all of our world-class training programs like Jack Street, Hammer, Field Strong, and Grindstone. To learn which Power Athlete training program best suits your goals, head to powerathletehq.com/training. And if you're a coach looking to build a business with the best training tech in the business, head to trainheroic.com/powerathletehq. And now back to the show.
I want to know why they stretch so long and go on the field and get hurt. Like, Beckham or whatever in that game, he hurts his knee, there's no contact. And because they don't train their calves and hamstrings.
Well, he tore his ACL.
Yeah. But if you've got strong hamstrings and calves, you will not turn.
Yeah.
I got medical books that says you can play. I tore mine. Tore 920 pounds. I was 52.
So I tore my ACL sometime towards the end of my NFL career, and we never even noticed. Yeah. It wasn't until I got my knee scoped. The doctor's like, you don't have an ACL. And he's like, I couldn't even tell you didn't have an ACL because your hamstrings were so thick.
Exactly. Yeah. It's the key. But they, you know, year in is, I write the books. I just write books and I stay down there. But you see, training is like waves, like the ocean. It seems like you got a wave of good training, then you got a wave of bad training. You know, no generation comes in. Right now, I've got to write an article. Tom wants me to write articles. The hardest thing I've ever done in my life, my opinion on HIIT training, because I know it sucks. And you know where HIIT training came from? I don't really want to tell you a whole lot.
Well, no, it
Arthur Jones.
Yeah, well, Arthur Jones. But I mean, also, Verkhoshansky wrote about it in Super Training. I mean, they showed circuits, and there was a GPP deal and base level of fitness.
Penn State.
Yeah, and Penn State.
Oh, I mean, we used to get into it.
All fuck! Ask him about the one set to failure on the hammer strength shit. I did that stuff. It was fucking awful.
Yeah, well, that's what he did. It wasn't a training method. It was a business mode model. He's going to kick you in there, going to run you through all those machines and out the door, next guy in.
Yep.
And he did it by convincing you that Casey Viator and all these guys got that big doing it.
Yep.
And I'm going like, you're out of your mind. I've had pro bodybuilders there. I don't like to work with them, but they're way stronger than you think they are. Especially some in the bench and in the deadlift. Mm-hmm. Yeah, enormously strong. Yeah, I got to write about it. And it's, you know, 20% of our training is only a barbell. Squat and a bench, deadlift, good morning. 80% small exercise, concentrate on one particular muscle group. But you got to have one particular weakness. So we concentrate on that one particular weakness until it exceeds the next thing, then we work on that. Well, we never give anything up. We're constantly working on it, like lower back and hamstring and triceps and, you know, the essentials that make you lift big weights.
So how, I mean, you know, for people that have been living under a rock, that don't know about the West Side system. I mean, can you get into a little bit of like how it was created? I mean, I know that the system you created was in response to not only your own injuries and the people around you and trying to make the best training system, but there's also this misconception that it's just for geared powerlifting.
No, it's for all sports.
It's all, yeah.
We powerlifting this big for us. All sports is gigantic. We're huge overseas. We're huge in South Korea, for instance. You know, who would dream that? So big, you know, we have to do a lot of trademark work and stuff. No, it's all sport. Danny DePasquale with the Melbourne Storm kills him every year. Been doing this for years. And then Phil somebody? He had the only team in the Premier League, 26-0, Westside Barbell. He wrote two books about it. That's what I mean. See, then those books go away and people go, well, I never heard of it. Yeah. Well, there it is, buddy.
Well, I mean, even the influence in, you know, the way I write stuff for Power Athlete comes from actually conversations we had where I remember you said, hey, I wouldn't train because I was asking you about training football players and athletes. And you were like, on your max effort work, I want you to do threes and fives, you know, in, you know, push out the rep maxes away from singles and start, you know, hitting a higher deal. And even on the compensatory acceleration, the speed work. Bringing that in and kind of a percentage of that. And it's paid in great dividends for us.
One thing we've done, we went to fives because my guys is too big of groups. And they were doing doubles, taking hours to do speed work. I go, this is ridiculous. We used to do this stuff in 20 minutes.
Yeah.
So I went to fives and people have asked me why. But the reason is because we can move five as fast as two. So we're putting out the same force, you know, that we were with two. So why not do it that way? And you're getting way better condition. And here's a thing I felt real strange about. Our guys, you know, at the end of the workout, when we're like 80-85%, could do 15 reps. People can't do that. They do doubles. They're like, you do three. We're doing 15 freaking reps. Then we go over and do our 25 deadlifts. I said, it's all work capacity, buddy. If you ain't got work capacity, you have nothing. You know, you win everything at the end. All football, all sports are won at the end.
Well, you got to be in shape enough and be durable enough to be able to survive the training to be able to get to game day. And the problem is, if you don't put yourself in that crucible, you're never going to have the capacity you need to be able to survive it.
Right.
You know, it's kind of like people always ask, you know, hey, if, you know, like if I got injured, I was still able to play. I'm like, yeah, because I got a lot of muscle on me. And unfortunately, or fortunately, like that's allowed me to go do this stuff. Like, you know, like, I mean, shit, I saw your thing where it's like, you know, weak things don't break. I mean, I watched a million dudes shatter on the rocks just because they weren't physically strong or mentally strong because they didn't do the training to get themselves there.
That's right. Yeah, you don't want to go somewhere you've never been every damn day of your life. You want to have already arrived there and just so it's commonplace.
Yeah, well, you never want to walk out on a Sunday and think the hardest work I'm ever going to do is on this day.
Yeah.
You need to be able to do the hardest work in training so that when you get there, you're like, oh, shit, now I can, you know, not relax a little bit, but believe me, it's not going to be as hard.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think what you've done a good job of is in the training environment here, when they probably go to the meet, it almost feels like a little bit of a vacation.
Oh, meets are a joke too, Faraday. The training is a joke. You know, you asked, you know, I mean, I brought my lower back. And I had a top toe in the world in 1973 and 81.
So what was your first year powerlifting?
I actually went to meet in 66, but then when I got out of the Army in 70, I started full time. But in 73, I had the top toe in the world, the 181s. You know, I had 670 deadlift. I remember I told myself to come out Toledo. No, there's no gear, zero. And I said, my back's indestructible. Well, I broke it doing good mornings. I'm on crutches for 10 months. So I come out of there, and that's how I invented reverse hyper. No one was going to fix me. I had to, you know, involve myself in my own therapy. So I did all that. Then 82, I break it again during 81. And I broke it again, and I couldn't lay down for 17 weeks. All right, so meanwhile, I say, there's got to be a better way. So I bought all the Bud, Conigan, whatever, you know. And I remember he said, Louie, he said, I don't think you want these. These are classroom books. I said, exactly what I want. I wonder what the hell I'm doing. Well, that's what changed it all. The Management of Training and the Weightlifter was the first book that really helped me. It would make any weightlifter. And most weightlifters never heard the book. That's amazing. And then, so I started doing it. Then I went to weight periodization. Where I go, I won't confuse people, but okay, you should go 75, next week 80, next week 85, then you drop back. So you jump 5%, 5%, and you drop back 10% and start it over. And it goes continuous.
Waves. Yeah, it's waves.
It's waves. Yeah. You wave. You can't just keep going up. And that's where, you know, when you handle weights at 90% above in the same exercise for 3 weeks, you go backwards. So that's how it all started. Then I just started breaking it down, you know, and then realized I had to have certain machines. But the weight periodization made a huge difference in what we do. So,
I mean, but you, I remember sitting down with you and going over the tonnage that I was lifting at the time. And you were like, dude, you're handling more tonnage and training than even our guys that are squatting 1,000 pounds, and you're not squatting 1,000 pounds. Yeah. And I remember we ended up going back and like breaking it all down and being like, hey, this is how you wave. And it was extremely impactful for me because I read your book. Before I came out. And then when I sat down with you, I realized that what's written in the book for Westside Fundamentals and all that isn't what's at Westside, which is in here in Columbus. So like that was cool to sit down and actually go over. And I'm like, well, that's not in the book. And you're like, not everything's in the book. You got to come to Westside to learn Westside.
Well, you know, if that gentleman squats 400 pounds and he's on that monolith over there and you squat 800 pounds and you're training at 80%, the bar should be moving at the same rate of speed. It's all about velocity training. Weights aren't heavy or light. They're fast or slow.
Yeah.
That's how they're measured. And so, again, when I learned that, when I got that in my head, I said, oh, this changes everything, you know? And so that made a big difference. Just one thing, I kept reading what they were doing, and I said, they're out of their mind. Well, they weren't. You know, like, I never, how many reps you do with 80 or 90%? Boom. I'd do as many as I could or one. I never followed charts. That Perlipin did, and he's one of the greatest coaches I ever had with the strongest guys. So I started following all that stuff. I mean, then everybody got behind me, and then we just started blowing stuff up. We broke about 170, 75 world records. Nobody, I bet there's not four gyms in the country or even more can say they've done that. But we, this gym down here, and I'm having hard, I got to buy lifters to come here. You know what I mean? It's hard to get lifters. But we're done. My girl, she just squatted 685 at 148. The 535 deadlift at 132, she's done. So it's all the same training.
So How much of it is like the gear? Because I remember the day I showed up, we floor pressed, and I remember I floor pressed like 500, and I think AJ did 505. And those guys were all, we were all right around 495, 500, and I felt pretty good. And then the next week we came in, those guys threw their shirts on, and AJ did like a 910, 920 bench off, I think it was 940 off of a 2 or 3 board. And he ended up bringing like, it was 900 down to his chest. So, I mean, the fact that that shirt had, I mean, he was real good in the shirt. I mean, 400 pounds of carryover. Like, is that pretty consistent in terms of?
With the gear now. I just wrote a book, The Greatest of Their Times. You know, who's the greatest football player? They can't say Brady. You know, I mean, you just can't.
No, it's era-based because that's the game changes.
Exactly. That's why I wrote this book. You know, the 10 greatest of their time. And I remember when you put Brees on and you fucked up your eyes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I guess you. Yeah. You, I'm going like, look at this guy.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll go, don't even touch me.
Yeah. Well,
I remember your banger. I was like, get the hell with me.
Yeah. Well, so he loaned me some briefs. And, you know, so when you put the briefs on, the pressure goes up. And all of a sudden, I like came off, and I came off so fast, I broke all the blood vessels in my eyes. And Louie was like, that's what I like to see, you know, like, hey, just fucking go for it. And I'm like, you know, like, I mean, it's like, if you put me in your Hellcat, I'm not going to fucking not put my foot to the accelerator or to the floor.
You just asked a question that I've asked, tried to get people to come here. What is the strength with gear? You know, when you bench, like I got a guy, I mean, he's got a new shirt. He did, he can bench 515. All right, and he's jacked way more than I was. I did 515, weighing 202. But he's benched 910 pounds at 81. So what is that strength?
Well,
I mean, like, you ever think about how would you hit if you didn't wear a helmet or didn't wear gear? Something would change. Yeah. I don't know what.
Well,
it's not going to change what we're doing.
Well, but think about this. I mean, the fact, like where I think people fucking poo-hoo it, what they don't realize is the structure that you need within terms of like bone density, ligament thickness, all that other shit, just to be able to support. Like I saw the video of that dude benching, what was it, 1322?
1320.
I mean, his bench, I mean, it's the biggest lift ever. I mean, nobody's ever squatted
he
that much.
Broke his record by 200 pounds.
Right? I mean, and what was wild is... you know, and I was reading the comments, and like people were like shitting on this dude about it. It blew my fucking mind. I'm like, do you know the fucking physical strength, bone density, ligament, connective tissue, just to be able to support 1,300 pounds and then have the balls to put it over your face and bring it down? Fuck all of you for even the fact that you shit on this dude. I'm like, fucking take half of that out with that. I mean, it's like they, I don't, fucking blows my mind.
Well, I remember when I just started, you know, I could bench like 340. And I remember doing rack presses and, you know, just barely getting 500 off a pin. I'm going, now how in the world are these guys bench 500? Actually, that was a pretty good big bench in 1970, you know. I mean, Pat Casey's 617, but you're going like, I'm going, how they do it? It's about to go right through my little pissy hands. Yeah, like I said, it's normal stuff.
Well, I mean, I benched, I squat 610 raw when I was 19, and then I benched 500 when I was 22. And I remember you telling me, heavy dumbbells. You got to have dumbbells up to 180 if you want to bench 500.
Yeah.
And it was floor press, and it was all this accessory work and triceps and heavy dips and all that. And close grips. You know, the close grip was the single, was the driver for me. Widen it out an extra thumb width and fucking 500 pounds straight up the chest.
Rob Fusner said when we would use change, you know, before bands, he said, you know, because we change our grips, said every time, if you're going to take your grip out, you need to set another set of chain on the bar. And, you know, really, he was right.
Yeah.
John, can you talk about the phone call to help you bench 500 pounds?
Yeah, so my roommate, Kevin Doherty, had a bunch of your West Side videos, the VHSs, and we would watch them. And then at the very end, Louis would put his number, West Side Barbell. You call and Doris would answer the phone and then yell for Lou and you come over. And you've done this for years.
Yeah.
I mean, the amount of people that you've coached virtually on just on a phone call and help people. I mean, I can't imagine if all the people lined up outside that actually called that number and were blown away. You know, I remember Doris said, "Lou," you know, and I mean, that's, I think, what's so interesting is, I mean, you know, for probably I'm sure there's a bunch of people like, ah, Louis Simmons is a fucking asshole. But the amount of people that you've helped without any. You know, like nothing in return other than use the training and fucking be a badass.
Just break a record. That's all I ask. Just prove my method. That's all I've ever asked a person to do. So what are you? Break your record. That's all I ask. If you're not, you're. And if a guy comes here, you know, we bring him in, and he doesn't get any better. We know he's no good. It's not us. It's him.
Well, and you've also
100 guys over. We've got over 100, 800 squatters, and 35 over 1,000. So people said one day, "Where's your scientific evidence on squatting?" I said, "Where's yours?" I said, "You got 100 guys have officially squatted, you know, 800." No. Oh, we got the biggest raw squat, Vlad. Vlad squat 1157 trained here. 1157 raw. So, but you see, things don't bother. It's not my job.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the other big one too is, I mean, like the idea of like using the box squat in terms of like taking out the stretch shortening reflex and being able to drive off the box. Can you talk a little bit about like that in terms of the ability to generate force and what that did for you guys as squatters?
Well, it's everything. I mean, when I was 14, I squatted 410, clean jerk 260, weighing 140 to meet at 14. I mean, I was drawing a little bastard. But at 18, I went in the Army, I squatted 410. I went nowhere. And I got in the Army and started reading Muscle Power Builder articles by, you know, Westside Barbell, Culver City. And I said, well, I got nothing to lose, nothing. So I started box squatting. 3 months I took a squat, you know, all boxes, I squat 450. And then, I mean, I did 665 roll in the 181s. You know, 2 hour weigh-in and no gear, no knee wraps, no nothing. So I was convinced, and everyone's ever come here, they all, I told you, I said, Vogelpohl never did a full squat. AJ, AJ never did one, 1210. Hoff, 1273. They didn't do any squats. It all box squats. I roll right out of them. Hell, if you can box squat, you can full squat. And you know what I found too over the years? I don't really write about it like I was. I've been a little sick couple here for a little bit. But when you can use a box, you can control the eccentric phase. Yes, you will go a lot lower on a box than you ever would without the box. And but you control that eccentric phase by sitting on a box. So, and you can sit down. Me and Dave, we did experiments with Nintendo, eccentric and concentric, and I could stay down with, it was 485 pounds and 375 a band. I could stay down on the box for 8 seconds to get up to the same speed. And they asked me, what's the big deal? So what about football players? You guys are on that line for a long time. It maintains that. It won't maintain, it's reversal strength, not plyometric. Because guys say, well, it will not do that. I never said it would. You know, it's so funny how people know little but don't know much. I didn't say it's plyometric. Because, you know, that's under 0.2 seconds. But, I mean, I remember Dave Tate was very powerful, you know, like extremely. He can sit down for 5. I think because his muscle fiber is different than mine. You know, but I can sit down for 8 and just same speed.
He told me that he was the fastest with the Tendo, but yet did not have anywhere near the biggest squat. So therefore the Tendo was useless. Which I love Dave's finality and everything. Because it didn't work for him, it must not work for anybody. Which
I mean, the Tendo to me was a measuring tool, and that's all it was.
Yeah.
I mean, I know what, you know, I can look at you and say, oh, those are way too slow, you know. Or they're way too fast.
Yeah. I mean, so, if it's too fast, you just add more weight.
That's right.
Yeah, good tool for the athlete to see the feedback.
Well, we were talking about where people are looking for like velocity-based training systems. And when we did is the group of people that I was training with, I remember we had a group of about 10 people and we were using a Tendo to try to figure out like our own kind of velocity curve where, you know, certain people, and the problem is it became like I had a girl who was a Canadian sprinter and was an unbelievably fucking very, very twitchy. I mean, she was like our outlier. And then we had another people and I tried to get like a huge cross section of athletes to see at which percentage of 1RM they could move at which weight. And I ended up figuring out that like it was so dependent on the individual. And yet you could almost put them through a series of tests beforehand to kind of figure out where they were, like, you know, foot contact time, reaction, all the other stuff, jumping. And there were certain people that were just more twitchy than others.
Mm-hmm.
And they were better, but it didn't necessarily mean, I mean, the strongest person we had, their fucking squat took them 10 seconds because they were so grind and slow. And well, I'm sure you've seen that too.
Well, that's the old problem of progressive gradual overload. And, you know, that stuff just don't work. And like you said, weights get bigger, they slow down. You know, you're in a game and you can't slow down. So everything, I mean, to lift the weight, you've only got so long to lift it. If you don't make it, maybe 2 seconds or 2.5, you miss. So people say, why speed? One, it develops a rate of force development. And a lot of people, like you said, they don't have that. That's what that develops. Yeah. So.
Well, I think what's cool about the NFL and professional sports and Olympic sports is it's kind of like genetic. You kind of get to this point where it's like the genetic freaks. And I'm sure with powerlifting, you've seen the same thing when you have guys in there that are, 5'6", 5'7", 300 plus pounds, I mean, there's not the average person's being able to handle that much and be able to do this. Mm-hmm. I mean, the first time we came in to lift, I think it was Tony Bologna.
Oh.
He put 1,100 pounds and came off the bar so fast that I almost was like, holy shit. I mean, I couldn't believe how fast that guy was off the box.
Yeah, if we just had time to transfer that into football, but we don't.
Yeah.
Because football's a major thing, for you, for football players.
Yeah. But, wouldn't you imagine, I would be really surprised if there was any football player that wasn't doing some form of speed work. Unfortunately, I've been kind of clicking on Instagram, and there's a guy who works with allegedly a bunch of offensive linemen. I was kind of clicking through the workouts, and, I'm always interested to know, what these guys are doing for their training, and more importantly, there's really not very good at lifting weights.
No. It's so funny. They kind of downgrade lifting weights, but what do you hear every? They got to get them in the weight room. And if it wasn't for weights, these strength coaches wouldn't have jobs.
Well, if it wasn't weights, I wouldn't have played in the NFL.
Well,
I was 6 foot, 165 pounds before I ever touched a weight, I was 14 years old when I went in. I know. Crazy. But I was telling him the story. I was probably 10 years old, maybe 11, and we were at the beach. And this is in Southern California where I grew up. And I was in this program called Junior Lifeguards, which was like a prep program for lifeguards. And it was some kids in, 10, 12, 13 years old do. And we were at the lifeguard station. And all of a sudden we kind of looked over, and on the strand, the concrete where people ride their bikes and walk, there was a whole mess of noise. We looked over and we thought it was a riot or somebody had died or, something. We could hear people yelling. So we went over there to kind of see what it was. And there was a guy walking down the boardwalk in a pair of shorts and a string tank top. And his chest was so big you could put a drink on top. And this guy, we saw him. And he kept walking past us and we started following him. And then he started running because there was a big ramp up to the top where the parking was. And he started running up and down it. And I remember thinking, I want to lift weights. And that guy was Lyle Alzado. Yeah. And so, played for the Oakland or Raiders. Lyle was a fucking monster.
Yeah,
and I've never in my life ever seen anybody that well put together. Huh. We didn't know who he was. And then all of a sudden we were telling, my dad who it was and turned on the TV and we're like, oh, that was the guy we saw. Huh. And he lived in our town.
Wow.
And Lyle Alzado was super impressive.
He ended up out the Browns.
Yeah.
And they were called the Wild Bunch and they said he was the craziest person they've ever seen.
Yeah. Yeah, he was a live wire
out there.
Yeah, he had a big gold chain. His chest, I just remember like this big, you could have put a drink right on top of his chest. He was a fucking monster. Huh. And I remember thinking I want to lift weights.
Yeah.
And that was important.
I think it's a lot of misconceptions. A lot of guys are strong, so they don't think you got to be strong. I've seen a lot of guys coach, not you, but Carl Gotch is a big example. You know who he was, a fighter,
who?
MMA.
What's his name?
Carl Gotch.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Okay. Well, Carl was real strong, but he didn't lift weights. He did push-ups, basic things. He didn't believe in weight training. Well, everybody's not Carl Gotch. That guy walked on, like you said. He wasn't like a bodybuilder, but guy was jacked, big. And another thing, I'll say this, it's what I believe. Tommy Kono was extremely strong. Man, he broke a lot of world records, and he became the head of American weightlifting, I think, 1972. And I'd go up to Ohio State, and they'd be snatching broomsticks. I go, what are you guys doing? Oh, you got to do this. You got to work on technique. Because Tommy had immense strength, terrible technique. So he thought you should train on technique all the time. But that was just Tommy. You see, you got to break him down. That's why he got different positions. You know, that's why you play a position and not, you know, somewhere else.
So with the, I mean, it's to me, it's pretty fascinating that, like, you know, because of the powerlifting, it's kind of gotten this idea. But, like, I mean, the fact that, like, you know, if you're looking at all these different athletes, world-class athletes that are using something within your system, it seems like, you know, the proof is in the pudding.
Especially in running.
Yeah, let's get into that a little bit. I remember that day we showed up. There was a girl who was, I think she was a 400 or 800 meter runner, who was over there doing just a bunch of med ball work, and she was doing a ton of stuff on the on the belt squat. I mean, it was unbelievable. I mean, that girl was physically impressive. Mm-hmm. You know, looking the part. So, I mean, in terms of the sprinting, like, how does the volume work? How does, like, is the training in at all specialized for them?
Yeah, well, I get a lot of feedback from people, but there's guys put on the Olympic medals by using my stuff, and they told me, you know, that they did it, the weight training, not the, and but one thing we found out, it took us a while, you can't do max effort weights and max effort sprinting in the same week. It will destroy you. You have to cut the weights out. That girl, I got a girl, she trains twice a week, real hard, real heavy, but twice a week, and then she used the other day for sprinting. When we try to max out twice, you know, a hard sprint and max out and with the weights, it all fell apart. Just could not handle the central nervous system, could not do it. So that's how we know close. We just do speed work and explosive stuff. 30-40% weights and basically 40-50% weights. That's what we concentrate on. But blow up the heavy reverse hypers and the inverse curl and all of those things. I'll blow it up.
So you can handle like a ton of volume and intensity with the accessory movements and have them still sprint at a high level.
That's right.
But it's actually the barbell stuff that becomes kind of diminishing returns.
Remember I told you about the jumps, and we didn't jump for 9 weeks. The girl broke her over 3 inches. Reach up and touch 9.7. Not bad.
Yeah, and I'm not bad at all.
Yeah.
So with the, I mean, like, are they monitoring the sprinting kind of similar like you would on Prilipin's table? You know, because I remember when we came in, we were talking about lifts over 90%, 4 to 10 reps. And my first question is, how do you know if you need 4 or 10? And I remember that was a funny conversation. And you were like, you know what? The more advanced the lifter, the greater central nervous system efficiency he has, the less volume he needs. The, you know, not, I guess the intermediate lifter who needs more volume kind of drives up towards that, you know, higher level of rep range.
Mm-hmm. Well, you ever read the book Faster Secrets to Underground Running Faster by Barry Ross?
No.
Forget that book.
Okay.
It's just a little book. They did experiments in there. They took about 33% of the running away. See, that's what I have to do. You got to tell me what you're doing, then I could go from there. But they dropped 33% of the running, and everybody ran faster. Their VO2 max didn't change, and everyone else kept doing the same thing, and I'll tell you about VO2, but anyhow, when they cut that running down, all their times increased. The group was kept the same, stayed the same. You know, your VO2 max in 1940 is the same as it is today. So everybody wants to concentrate on too much oxygen, you know, when it's the muscle endurance you have to have. I know a lot of fighters, and they said to go out there, and they started going out to Colorado or whatever, and high altitude and all this. And they had tons of lungs, but their muscles just did not work very well.
Well, I mean, really, like, how much can you really train on your VO2 max? That's, I was kind, right, of always, I always thought you're kind of born with a VO2 max, and maybe there's a 5-7% that you can kind of go up, but it's not like, you know, a guy like Lance Armstrong that had a VO2 max over, what, like 200 or something crazy.
Yeah, I'm guessing because this is most, they said in 12 to 18 months of intense training, you got it. That's it.
Yeah. And it's not
necessary. You can get strong for years. Hell, you can still get stronger than you've ever been if you wanted.
I'd like to believe that
no doubt.
The best of my life is still ahead of me. I still believe that my best lifts are in front of me.
How old are you?
45.
See, I was over 50, and I 2 inches inside the ring, I benched 500.
Yeah.
If I did it, you damn well could do it.
Well, I remember we were out here, what, 10 years ago when you were in your 60s, and I saw you rack pull damn near 700 pounds. And then all those kids were talking shit to you, and you fucking went over there and strapped it up. I mean, it was impressive.
I rack pulled 765 on pin 3 when I was 63.
Yeah.
And that when I was also, I pulled 675 in a meet easy in a meet, weighing 217. And then my neck took off.
Yeah, I remember when we were out here, you were having that deal where when you went to unrack the bar, all of a sudden it was kind of putting stress on the spine.
Doing something weird. Doing something weird. I don't know why. It got worse and worse, and this mess now. I'm a mess right now. I tell you what, I can say my body, every ounce of my body I put in this sport, it's killed me. I mean, it's destroyed me, but I wouldn't have learned anything if I had to. All I do is go home and read or I write. I read or I write. That's all I do. So you do that. I mean, I read. I mean, you know where people, I'll ask you a question. Here, let me get my phone out and I'll tell you. For me, if I want to know something about anything, I'll start looking it up. Meanwhile, I go through 5-6 chapters, but then I'll stop along the way and I'll learn a lot of things in chapters I wasn't even going to look at. And I think that's a big help. I think that's a difference today about real intelligence. And I'm only smart in one thing. You're like, if it wasn't for Tom and my wife and a girl, I'd be in big trouble.
Yeah.
I'm serious. I'm a complete moron. I almost died twice. That didn't help. And then, but they do everything for me. I mean, my mind, I'm like a shark. They always said a dinosaur had a mind, a brain of about the size of a walnut. Well, hell, they lasted a while. I go, I'll last other. How big's your brain got to be?
Yeah.
If you really want to be Albert Einstein, I mean, he probably couldn't start a car. So I'm not Albert Einstein. But I mean, the thing is, I put all my attention into one thing and then boom, And I got guys I'm constantly experimenting with. And I think that's what you got to have. You got to put them in groups. That's what we did. Changed the band. I had a chain group. Well, there was no bands. And we made progress. We went to bands and made tons of progress. But we would do this with a certain amount of loads. Just change things around and find out which one worked. I mean, I had, back in, Kenny Patterson, I mean, a 640 raw bench at 260 and 6 1/4 Georgia, 225. And I mean, I was a strong ass guy. They were all like that. So it was a good group to experiment. Because these, like you said, they were like NFL, but we powerlifted.
Yeah. Well, I mean, when I walked in, I mean, I hadn't seen an environment like that since training camp. It was it was fucking good. I mean, it was comforting, but I could also see where people walk in and think, oh, fuck, what am I getting myself into?
Well, other people wouldn't come for a long time.
Well, the best was when we walked in, I think there was a bunch of like CrossFit people showed up, uh-huh. And they were like standing by the door and didn't know if they were going to like get mugged, get beat up, get killed. Like they didn't want to come in there, And it was funny. It was cool to see.
I miss that. That's what I miss.
Yeah. In terms of like athletic development, like, do you have like a template for, like athletic performance from like a young age? If you were going to like, if you could, like my son is 5 and I hand him over to Louis Simmons at Westside Barbell, like how does that progression look? And more importantly, like when would you first kind of, like how would you train him early on? When would you start introducing the barbell, like that life cycle of an athlete?
Okay. Well, I wrote a book called The Rule 3. It's what the Russians had to train young children from actually about, from 4 to 10 or whatever, but the rule 3. And 3 years before you even pick a sport. Like, if your dad, I don't know what your dad did, but he might have played football, so you're playing football.
No, my dad was a lawyer, and he was from but he was from Culver City.
So, oh wow!
Yeah. So I grew up in Torrance, Palos Verdes area, which is right on the other side of the freeway from that. So when you said Culver City, I know that area.
Well, I don't like to work with kids, but they bring a few come in. First thing I tell the parents when they go back, get them into wrestling school, get them into basic gymnastics.
Yeah,
got to teach them athleticism, and where you're also touching people and not being afraid to wrestle someone, putting your elbow across your nose and all that, and then just start practicing ball sports, hand and eye coordination, walking down planks where they can walk down I just usually put a 2x8 on the ground. Then a 2x6, 2x4, take it on down. Where they can walk, build balance, know that. Balance coordination, and then decide what their aptitudes are towards what ball sport, if they're going to play ball.
Mm-hmm.
So, can they shoot a basketball or can they box? Some boxers, great boxers are born.
Yeah.
They're trained after they're born, but they are born. I mean, I had 6 pro fighters in the ring years ago. I was all right 40. They want me to guarantee with Pete the cramp. I'm going like, I've never had no little ass guy, but, you know, I mean, I'm trying to hit them over here, hit me in the side of the head. I go, how do you do this?
Yeah.
I've always been a great boxer because I admire what they could do, but I couldn't do it because the star too old.
Yeah.
So what you could learn at before 10, you may never learn at 13 on.
Mm-hmm.
And in Russia, I don't know if you know, it starts at basically 13. You have a progression 13 to 15, kind of like if you play ball. And then from 15 to 17, and you got to get better, 17 to 19. And from 19 to 21, you are major, you're going. It's good. And if you make it at 19 on, it's called you're polished. If not, you're out the door. You're not going to be a weightlifter. You're not going to be a boxer. You're not going to be. I remember this Kuchar. I watched the deadlift 793 and a 165. And so he couldn't speak English. He was in Ukraine. And I said, well, what did he do? I said, did he weightlift? Because this guy had those back muscles like you've never seen. And he goes, no, he wrestled. And I said, was he any good? He goes, no, just nice to caliber. That's the only thing. Probably like you. You know, if you didn't play D1 football, don't even talk to me. You're not a football player. You know, at least D1 football. And then into the pros.
Yeah.
No. You're a good example because I remember you were showing Kerr down there, Josh Kerr. You were beating the crap out of him. He said, I've never seen this stuff before. He said, Ohio State. Well, I have to say it's only four or five top schools in the country for football. He'd never seen that stuff.
No, he didn't know how to use his hands. He didn't understand about position, angles, any of this stuff.
Right.
And so this kid was hoping to go play in the NFL. And I'm like, hey, man, I'm going to give you a fucking crash course on how to do this. And he didn't understand about he kept uncoiling his hips, didn't understand how to rebend. He was a waistbender, not a knee bender. Didn't understand hand position, two-thirds inside out. I mean, all the shit I learned boxing as a kid and fighting, how to cut a guy off in the ring was pretty applicable to being a play offensive line. Like the quarterback's here, I'm here, you're here. This is all a game of angles, understanding how to position to, you know, and then also the first meaningful touch, how to redirect somebody's momentum once they're there, how to basically, you know, challenge posture and position through full range of motion movements. I mean, this kid had never heard any of this. And he's looking at me like, and Louis looking at me, and he's like, well, there's a difference between a guy that plays in the NFL for 10 years and this fucking kid who's probably sweeping the streets, which he didn't like when you told him that.
Yeah, but it's exactly what I'm talking about right now. You know, he didn't have anyone to teach him. Obviously, you did. Thank God. I mean, I think like boxing and all that, like you said, you fought. I think that's one of the best things. Build some courage, man. Get used to hitting in the face.
Well, you also realize the power of the first meaningful touch. Like when you come out there and like, you know, you understand like striking distance. And like it was always interesting for me where I'd see guys like wait and I'm like, I can throw your hands out there. But then a lot of guys are fearful because they don't have the athleticism to be able to move in space. That if their hands miss, can their feet make up for it? And my whole deal was within the confines of the box, you know, my 3x3 area, nobody was going to out-athlete me. You know, like, I mean, you might be able to shoot hoops or this other stuff, but like I was a master of my domain. And to the point where like I constantly wanted to fool people into thinking, fuck, that guy's athletic. I might not be athletic in the way, but within the confines of this box, I'm a better athlete than you.
That's all it counts. It's funny because way back in it'd be 92, 95. I had a lineman come in, play for the Giants and train here for a while. And he was telling me it's all feet. He said, if you don't have that feet, you ain't playing.
Jumping rope.
Yeah.
You know, being able to move through space.
It's in my book. Man, I get Tom to give you all my stuff when you leave here. Whatever you guys want, just ask him what you want. I said jump rope because it also builds up more strength for the connective tissue.
No, I mean, I always felt the jumping rope was one of the best speed exercises I ever had.
Oh.
You know, and then also conditioning with like high knees jumping and being able to get your knees up.
Do you see many people do it?
I program the shit out of it for all of our programs. I mean, so there's a... Man, I've said this for years on this podcast. I stand on the shoulders of giants. I didn't invent any of this shit. I've just been fortunate enough to have the coolest friends and been able to have the best mentors. Like, you know, old man Zhang is talking about, you know, Hatfield's compensatory acceleration. When we interviewed Fred, talking to him about it and how he, you know, figured this thing out and how he, I mean, these are all how you learn within the mentor process or coming out and hanging out with you for a couple weeks and seeing like the West Side system, not from reading the books, but actually seeing it from the inside and understanding. And I tell people all the time, you can read all the books you want on West Side, but until you go to West Side and talk to Louis, you don't really understand the program.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Fred was a big influence on me. You know, I'd see my mates and we'd talk a minute and he'd say, you know, well, you got to have an electric stem. Well, I'll go buy one. You need an ice connect machine. I'd go buy one. You know, whatever it was, whatever he said, I said, hell, I'm getting this thing.
Well, he was a gymnast. And he told us the story on an airplane where he kicked up into a handstand and was doing freestanding handstand push-ups on an airplane because some guy told him he couldn't do it. And I remember we asked him, like, how many did you do? He's like, I think I did 50. And I don't know if it was if that was a catfish story or what, but fuck, can you imagine Fred Hatfield kicking up in the aisle and doing 50 freestanding handstand push-ups?
Yeah, crushing record squats and then backflips right behind the barbell.
Yeah.
Because he's so excited.
You see, that's why I watched that with Olympic weightlifters overseas. You know, I mean, the ones that would do it, lift and do a backflip. I'm going like, man, I couldn't do a backflip. My life depended on it. Yeah. It is funny how you learn. You got to, I've told people many times, I'm a much better student than I am a teacher. I learn. I listen what, you know, I come out here by what you say, I'll pass it on to somebody. I got a million football players always wanting to stop in here, and I just don't have time anymore. And I mean, I can't do it no more.
Well, you also told me that it wasn't fun to train them anymore because you'd already figured it out.
Yeah.
I remember we were talking about it, and I was like, man, how come more football players don't show up? And you're like, I'm not interested in it. I already cracked that code. I want to work in. I remember at the time you were telling me, you're like, I want to work with the fighters. I think that's the, you know, that's where I can see a lot of what we're doing really have great carryovers in the fight community.
Yeah. And then the problem, well, yeah, they pay me a lot of money to talk to MMA. I'm huge in MMA.
Yeah.
People have no idea, you know. But, yeah, it's like, I mean, I'll bring guys. Josh is one of my football players. But I would average 12 guys. I average 3 tens in 2 months.
Yeah.
And, all you know, big guys aren't, you know, I mean, I can't compare, you know. But, you know, you take a guy who weighs what you do, and you take a guy who weighs 160. There's no way that big guy can do the chin-ups or pull-ups that guy could do. Relative strength, they need relative strength. And the little guys need brute-ass strength. Try to, you know, keep them being mauled. That's what I found. And it was you know, what we did, they maxed out with us, and they normally put them by themselves. Max out, speed day, lots of 80 jumps a week, and a lot of sled working, pushing and pulling sleds. That's what that is all was. I never ran them. But the higher you jump, the faster you'll sprint.
Sure.
So especially for football, you ain't going, you know.
Can you talk about like the influence and more importantly, the importance of training groups? That was the one thing that was like different compared to any place else I've been. And I mean, we saw it in the NFL. You find, like, for me, I would find the guy who was either the strongest, and if I was the strongest, the next strongest guy. And like, that was within my training group because you need somebody to compete with. I mean, that's something that nobody talks about. And really the thing when people ask me about Westside, I'm like, it was the intensity and the competition in the daily training groups where almost Louis over there, like the fucking mad scientist, pitting people against each other, talking shit. This guy says he's stronger than you. That guy's not stronger than me. I mean, that's psychological warfare and the effectiveness of the groups.
My friend said I could make Gandhi kill somebody.
I watched him fucking get in somebody's head and then fucking people storming out, fucking trying to break things. It was great.
Yeah, it's everything. I mean, you, like I said, environment's everything. My gym lacks environment right now. We used to bet so much money. I mean, not, you know, it'd be $200-$300 on a box for the box. Who could box out the most? $200-$300 on deadlift platform. It was every week almost. And it wasn't about the money, you know. I don't know, but I mean, money never motivated me, but I'm going like, I want that money, even though I never won it from young. And then also team things. We'd have 2 and 3 man team in like deadlift, squat, or you know, rack pull or something. And like, what we'd add, like us three would add up our number to beat them. And if you needed 20 pounds above your all-time record to win, 9 times out of 10, you pulled it. Because you had that little team thing going on there. And I think that helped. And actually, you know, I blew my knee off in 91. I was done. I mean, I accomplished everything I thought I could do. And then Kenny Pastor pulled me out of retirement. I said, Kenny, are you ever going to bench 7 again? He's world record holder. And he just, you know, falling off. And he looked at me and says, old man, you'll never have 7 pounds on your back again. Well, I come out of retirement right then.
Yeah.
And this is 1997. And by 2002, I was squatting 100 more, 920. Only Eddie O'Connor, I was squatting me. I had the 4th biggest total that year. And the reason is, and I'll tell you the reason is, did the training change much? No. Dave Tate and Chuck is like a ditch digger. You know, you go to work, you got to dig 300 feet of dirt if you want to get paid. So you work like a fool. And Dave Tate, I've said it, biggest liar, cheat I've ever seen. Your box is high. No, my box is high. You know what I mean? Always trying to take a mat out. We say, you take it out there. You know, those guys, that motivate, those guys push me. Like Dave said, he tried to kill me 100 times. I tried to kill him too. And it paid because I was 20 years. You know, they're 50. I'm 74. But I said, F them. And they knew I would never back down. I mean, they hauled me out of here a couple of times. I never backed down.
Well, I mean, the fact that you've fucking obviously, you know, like I always, the analogy I think is like a wet rag. You basically have wrung this thing out for every drop in it, yeah. And you're at 74. I mean, it goes to show that at the end of the day, the person that can remain strongest is usually the person that's going to last the longest.
Yeah.
You know, when they look at actuary tables, it's actually the person that maintains lean body mass and muscle mass the longest pushes themselves out. It's when people get weak or their, you know, nervous system gets weak and they fall, break a hip, and they become weak that ended up, that's the end of you.
Yeah, what happened to me, I got my neck hurt, and then kid wanted me to spar. I said, okay. I said, you can kick me in the head, but don't kick me in the knees. Well, kick me in the knee. Last tendon I had, it was a torn tore. All four of my tendons. I thought I could get it repaired. But I go to Cleveland up in Strongstown, Mark Marinetti was, you know, Stipe and all them guys. And the doctor goes, you really? He said, there's no help. You need a new knee. And that really, so that was pretty much it.
Did you get a knee replacement?
Yeah, on this one here. This is screwed up, but I guess as long as I train on it, I'm fine.
So you got a knee. I know you got a hip and a shoulder.
No, a knee and a shoulder.
Okay, knee and a shoulder.
Yeah, I got a shoulder replacement, benched up 100-pound dumbbells, 34 reps.
Yeah.
And I tell people, I just really think about therapy. Get on therapy fast. Don't wait. You know, when they operate on you, you're going to move your arm or your knee every which way it can go. Then they put it in the cast and don't want you to move for 8 weeks. And that's never made any sense to me. So I don't do it. I go right back, buddy. I benched a broomstick. I benched a broomstick in 7 days after surgery with my shoulder. And in 3 months, raw, I benched 300. Now, they still got people in arm casts. But I didn't do it that way. I used the band bar, ultra high reps. We hadn't had the band bar at the time, but a straight bar with the vibrating kettlebells and light dumbbells up to 200 reps with 25-pound dumbbells and stuff like that. You know, soft tissue work, that's all I did.
Yeah.
Every day.
One of my favorite moments of Westside was we had, the bamboo bar was still pretty new. And so, like, a lot of people hadn't seen it. We came in. I remember we worked on it. And then I left and I came back. And that day, one of the guys were doing it. We went over there. And the guy's like, hey, you want to jump in and give this a try? I was like, sure. How does it work? And so the typical thing is you try to invite the new guy, not realizing he's going to fucking kill himself. And I laid down and, like, just, like, nice and easy motion. And, like, it was confused. I'm like, oh, let's throw a little on. This was kind of easy. And then all of a sudden hit it again. And the guy's like, have you done this before? I'm like, of course. But yeah, I mean, we got to the point where we were trying to break that thing. I think we loaded it up with 315 pounds and we were able to get 5 to 10 reps.
Yeah, I did 270 for 9. But what I found too is a therapy bar, but the stronger I was on, like you're saying, the stronger my bench was. I did 270 for 9. I watched Hoff do 335 for 10. I mean, he's not even beginning to be in that level, but
yeah. The one thing that was interesting, and I was going to ask you a little bit on it. With the bamboo bar, when you bring it down, it's kind of a straight line, like a little bit of an arc. But then you talk about, like, with the shirt. I mean, those guys bring touch and they almost drive this way. No, but rotation. Then when you watch raw benching, there's almost like a J curve or like
But whenever you do this, you're rotating your tear rotator. It's just a matter of time. Pec or rotator.
So that idea of keeping it tucked and going in a straight line, opposed from that kind of little bit of a...
Yeah, I've always, you know, always kept it straight line and never got hurt. Takes a strong upper back, side, and rear delt. And it's strong tricep.
And strong lats to be able to hold it in a position,
all
too.
All that, yeah.
I remember telling me that.
But you kind of like take the pec bit out of it. Howard kept tearing pecs. He had a concrete block for chest. And I said, George... You have got, and he had a 475 raw bench. Now, it went well. I said, George, until you make your arm stronger than your chest, you're going to keep tearing your chest because the right muscle has to fire correctly. Well, that's what coordination is. And it took like a year and a half, and he finally got through his head, and he never tore back again.
Yeah. More tricep within his bench.
I watched him bench. He benched 315 for 40, and Mike Wolf did it for 50. 315.
Jesus.
That's
a lot of fucking reps.
Yeah.
Well, I got a question on potential. So you've had thousands of athletes come through the doors, all different sports. Is there a moment when you decide to invest in someone? Is it when you see them fail on a rep, see them succeed on something, that you start to pour in?
I look at it, I just generalize the whole thing. Not like a missed that. I mean, you know, all I do, my coaching theory, I just tell them to do one thing and I leave them alone. I don't coach. And people said, how you set all the programs up? I don't. The percent thing's easy. Like I said, it don't matter if you squat 200, 600, 800, it's all based. It's all math based. You know, if you squat six, so you're using weights equivalent to that for 25 reps. And okay, so add that volume up. And then, you know, then next week, if you did seven, add that up, your volume goes way up. See? And so it's all based. That way you never, see, people don't get it. You never overtrain with the system. Because there's guys who come in and try to get you to do, you know, you go into a gym, you get this real strong guy. Everybody tries to emulate him. He'll get hurt and he keeps getting stronger. So see, this way it's based on your potential, not anyone else's. And I just keep him in line with that and say, dude, you got no hamstring or low backer. I got a kid down there. He'd been here right at a year, and he had a 525 deadlift in 181, so pulled 700. That's some serious progress. You know, so it's just working on what you got to work on. You know, don't work on things that don't work. My friend Sicario overseas said it does no stone to be strong in the wrong with the wrong exercise, and he's right. And you can be the greatest whatever, but if you ain't paying that position, what good did it do you?
So I guess it's all trial and error based upon the individual. You know, the idea of finding the right exercises as your drivers.
Well, I mean, if your knees come in, you got weak hips. You know, if you round up, you probably got a weak lower back or stomach. If you press bars over your face, you got weak arms, and you put too much on the shoulder, no doubt you're going to get hurt. And I tell guys down there, and they do it, and they go, man, I wish I'd have listened. I said, I wish you had it too. I mean, I got a kid that squatted 10, 40, 45 at 220, and I kept saying, when you start getting some weights on nowadays, you're tight, put some briefs on. I don't care if it's Carhartt shorts. Now he tore his groin, so. And then he would bench it too heavy, super heavies, and he's my height. He'd have to catch stretch the weight out. I said, you're going to tear a pec, getting that way out. And he did. But completely ruined his bench. Now, you know, what do you do? I just hope he tells people don't do what he did. You know, that's all I can ask.
Why? I mean, it seems crazy to me that if you got to make every mistake yourself. I remember my dad told me, he's like, if you got to make every mistake yourself, you're going to have a hard fucking life. So like, if you can't learn from the mistakes of others, then, you know, you're going to struggle. Right. So, I mean, you know, here's a situation where you're, you know, haven't done this for, you know, shit, 40, 50 years, and you're bringing people in and giving them information and they're still not grasping it, or more importantly, making the changes.
Yeah, and I think, like you talked about gear, I think gear, in a way, has kind of ruined our sport. Although, I'm all with, if you wear gear, that's you make the rules, I follow the rules. But I, these guys, instead of getting a stronger bench, you want a stronger shirt.
Yeah.
You know, if they want a stronger deadlift or squat, they get a stronger squat suit. Can't do that, man. You've got to do the work. Sled dragging is one of my primary things, man. You got to drag sleds. Well, you didn't see her, but Kylie, I mean, she's like 5'9" and a half, weighs 136. She pulls five plates on a sled all the time. It's 225 pounds on blacktop. And she carries the med ball to stay straight up and down. You don't want to go leaning forward when you pull sleds, or you put all the weight on your toes. And you keep it off the glutes. You want to keep it on the glutes, so.
Damn.
But like I said, it's just piecing things together. Like, it's like a puzzle. What part of the puzzle is missing? Fill that part in, and now you got a picture, you know. Yeah. And potential is, I could tell guys are, they're going to be good, you know, after a while. It's hard to get guys even as the right body. I mean, it's very, very, very hard.
You mean for powerlifting?
Yeah.
What do?
It's way too tall and skinny.
What would be the ideal? Like what? Dave Hoff? What's he like? 5'5"?
Oh, yeah, he probably Dave's about an inch or two taller than me at the most. Like at 165, should be 5'5". These weightlifters have come here, and I said, I'll tell you why you guys suck. Yeah, they lack two things. I mean, I'll tell them. You know, I wrote a book on, and it's just like the Chinese. They said I'm crazy. Go read what the Chinese do. Chinese got my equipment.
Well, and the other thing is they have a system, and they look for people that fit the anthropometrical ratios of their system.
That's right.
And then the other thing too is those guys Olympic weightlift, but shit, the amount of bodybuilding work they do is insane.
Oh, I know. That's what I mean. They say I don't like the word, but they say after every workout they do two bodybuilding exercises. I don't like. I'd rather just, you know, build muscle. Mm-hmm. But man, look at them guys.
Yeah, they're impressive.
Oh my God.
But I mean, you got what, billions of people in your country. That's and, you know, it's a communist deal. I mean, there's probably like, and you're going to be a weightlifter, you know, yeah. Whereas we're in a little bit of a different deal.
Yeah. And if you don't meet, you're right back on the farm.
You're sweeping streets or whatever the hell, or you get a bad social credit number. What do you think? I mean, obviously the legacy of Westside, but like with like the mindset and more importantly, like, you know, not just the sets and reps, like what do you think Westside has contributed to this whole thing?
And powerlifting in general?
Yeah, powerlifting success, athleticism.
Constantly reaching new heights, you know. As I said, we break records all the time. I have 123 with no gear. You squatted 635, world record. With gear, you squatted 700. He mentioned 505 and 23s and the 32s. So then the girl, you know, I mean, she got tons of you go down there right now, I can, like, we got a lot of world records on that wall, and I'm disappointed because I need new blood. Like, you know, every year, why you got football combines? You can't just keep playing for the same players. A few years down the line, there wouldn't be nobody playing football.
Yeah. What, I mean, are you struggling to bring in new blood?
I'm trying. I mean, we put ads out and everything, but it's, I don't know, man. The world, Marcus up there with, in the Strong Style says it's hard to find a guy that really like where he wants to hurt you. They don't, you know, it's like a, more like a sport to them, which MMA is a sport. But I've been around these guys. I mean, some of these guys, like Mark Coleman, these guys, they don't fucking rip your arm. You know, they could turn on you in a second, like a dog, you know. And he says it's so hard to find a guy like that. Attitude. You're not going to quit. If you get beat, then you'll be back next week. And mm-hmm. It's, yeah, it's the same. I just think it's society. Really do. I think it's got a lot of, like you said, there's a lot of things to it, but it's society. It has to be. I hope. You know, we're over here, like my buddy in there, he said, and he over there in Ukraine, all they're raising these kids, 13, 14 years old, to be soldiers. We can't decide if you're boys or girls over here anymore. That's a big fucking difference when you're going to run into combat with them.
Well, I mean, it's what's interesting is when you start removing hardship, and if you listen to the way people are kind of talking today, life has never been this good. It's never been this simple. It's never been this easy. I mean, the most access. I mean, the fact that you can get on your phone and have any type of food you want delivered to your house within minutes, which still blows my fucking mind. I mean, we've talked about on the podcast. Like, I'm probably like Louis. I've never ordered food online. Like, I'm like, but like, you can order anything.
Nine numbers.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, so it's like things have never been this easy. And I think what happens when things are this easy, people start searching for hardship or they start searching for ways. And unfortunately, they're not looking for the good hardship. But when you put people in these situations, like you're in the Ukraine, like you said, they're arming kids.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, they're forcing them into a certain life, whereas
it's all they know. My buddy, you know, he's a John Sayer jiu-jitsu, and says he'd go to Brazil. And even Carlos Carvella was here. He told me when they were, he says, down here, poor is, you know, beat up housing project. Down there, it's living in a cardboard box.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to see true poverty, I mean, we went to Brazil, we went to Rio, and seeing the favelas and the shanties and like metal roofs, I mean, with how people are living. I still tell the story. We were walking down the street, and there was an alleyway, and there had to be about 50 kids were playing futsal with that little ball. They were playing this game. They were playing soccer in this alleyway. And there was probably a 25 on 25 with this little ball. And these kids were playing this game. And it was amazing to see. And it was the only place that they could play that wasn't out in the streets. And they didn't have access to this. And they were playing this game. And whenever you ask people about why the Brazilians are so good at soccer, it's because they play this futsal game, which is this little ball, real high, you know, real high speed. And I mean, that's all they do. That's all they got.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so when you put people into these situations, greatness, you know, becomes the inevitable kind of return.
Yeah, you imagine if you even get a uniform. I mean, that's a prize thing if you got a uniform.
Or shoes.
Wear. Or shoes.
Or
yeah,
cleats.
Probably, yeah. Yeah. So.
I mean, the. I
probably treat these guys too good.
Well, I mean, think about it. Like in the 80s, I mean, I remember seeing those videos. I mean, the amount of lifters and people fighting to come here. And is it because, like, I mean, people aren't looking to suffer, they don't want the hardship, or is it just so easy because you have access? I mean, you remember, I mean, like you said, you had to call you on the phone. Now it's like, you know, there's internet forums and books, and there's so much access to information.
I know, I hate it. Because they handle it all, and I don't get to, anyone who wants my number, I give it to them because I'm supposed to talk to them. I don't need someone talking for me, you know, what the hell they're doing anyhow.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know what I'm doing down here and what they're doing up there. So I need to talk to them. And like I said, I found too, if you had done this, you'd probably talk to a person or two and just, oh my God, I'm so inspired to, you know, go play football or whatever. Some probably drove you into football. Who knows?
Well, for me, so my older brothers played football. And I remember, you know, going out there and playing. Like what's funny is my brothers used to make fun of me because I was real skinny, had a real skinny neck. My brother used to take an orange and put it on a pencil and then be like, snap it and be like, this is your neck. And so, like I said, I wanted to lift weights and I wanted to be bigger and stronger. And I knew that all the guys that played football were all big and strong dudes. So I figured, like, they all go to that weight room thing. I'm going to go to that weight room thing, like playing football. I want to be big and strong. And I got out there and I realized that playing football, especially at that age, was like fighting against people that didn't know how to fight or box. And because we had done a ton of fight stuff early on, and I got out there and was like, oh shit. And then all of a sudden I grew taller. You know, I had 100 scholarship offers. And I remember my dad telling me, he's like, are they going to pay you to go to school? And I was like, I think so. I think this is what these letters mean. And I remember just wanting to go to school to get a degree. Cause I mean, I never thought I'd play in the NFL, but the fact that I got to go play to school and I could, like, you know, didn't have to ask my parents to pay for anything. And then I got out there and I was just stoked to go to college. And then I remember I was on the scout team as a freshman, redshirt. And the guys I used to go against every day, they got drafted. Both guys got drafted in the top 10 to go play in the NFL, Dwayne Clemens and Reagan Upshaw. And I remember thinking, like, I fought those dudes every single day and they didn't beat my ass that bad. I can do this job. And then all of a sudden you're going out and you're playing against guys on Saturdays that all of a sudden are getting drafted in the NFL and they're playing pretty good. And you're like, you know, and I remember I played against a guy, he got drafted and he started as a rookie and I'm watching him thinking, fuck, I whooped up on this dude. And now he's starting in the NFL and playing pretty well. And then all of a sudden you get to the chance where you're thinking, shit, I can do this. Mm. And then you go out there. And I remember showing up as a rookie, realizing that the jump from high school to college was like orders of magnitude greater than the jump from the college to the NFL. It wasn't that big a jump. I mean, I remember showing up at 18 and there were 23-year-old dudes with beards. Mm. Now all of a sudden I'm 23 playing against 30-year-old men. And it's not that big a difference. And then you get out there and you realize, like, man, I can do this job. And then it starts becoming fun. And then you get to basically impose your will and get paid a lot of money to go fucking beat people's asses every Sunday in front of millions of people in cool uniforms. I mean, what a fucking great job. Who wouldn't want to do that?
I've always said, going out in front of those crowds.
Yeah, you run out there and, you know, 100,000 people cheering and screaming. And you basically get to, like, I mean, the shit that you'd probably go to jail for if you did out in the street, you get to get paid and it's fucking, it's glorified. People cheer your name for it. And I mean, I would have done it even if there wasn't anybody in the stands, just for the fact that you get to know exactly how good and bad you are every single Sunday. And I think, you know, with powerlifting and your training, you have the ability to go in and actually measure how good or bad you are every time you step to the bar. And I think that's what I always loved about lifting weights. And the fact that the weights have no fucking memory, which I think is the funniest thing. You know, you go in and you lift weights and you're like, man, I used to crush this weight and it doesn't remember me.
I know.
It's like this, like, I tell people this constantly, like the weights have no respect for you. They have no memory. Just because you did it a year ago doesn't mean you can do it today. And that motherfucker doesn't care about you.
I've always said, if you think you're cocky, just put 5 more pounds on the bar. You know what I mean? It really taught me a lot. It kept me out of a lot of trouble when I was a kid. A lot.
So when what made you get into powerlifting? I mean, you said you were in the Army and you got out, but what was
Because right out of high school, I Olympic lifted, you know, started at 14. And I had to work all the time. I was out of town, but I worked. And I was 260 at 14 years old, 140 pounds. But then there's a Larry Pacifico had a meet out in Dayton, Ohio. And I was getting drafted 2 weeks later. I went out there. And because I would lift here and I get first, second, third, you know, almost invariably wherever I went in Ohio. And I went out there and there was 11 guys. I beat a 55-year-old man. I was 10th. I go, this is my sport. And I'm looking at these guys. I'm going like, what the? How do these guys get built like this? You know, compared to weightlifters, you had to put a sign on them. I lift weights. And I said, this is it. I'm done. I've never powerlifted again. I like power clean. I power cleaned 320 at 180 with a bar that didn't revolve. Remember those Hercules 555 sets? It didn't revolve. And but then when I broke my back, I could never power clean again. Could not roll my hips forward. Killed my third lumbar vertebrae. I mean, like, devastated.
And you did that doing good mornings.
I did it doing 435 good mornings for five. Yeah, up at Ohio State of all places. Let me go up there and I wasn't used to a lot of confusion. I trained in my basement all the time by myself. You know how college campuses are. And I lost my concentration and man, it hauled me home. Laid on my floor for 3 days, peeing in a coffee can in my living room. That was a lot of fun. A lot of fun. That's when I realized, because after 10 months, no one was going to, I was not going to get fixed. I was not going, I'm going, if someone's going to fix me, it's going to be me. And I dreamed up to doing a reverse hyper exercise. And that's what did it. So that's you know, one thing that's led to another, like you, one thing led to another, to another, to another. You know, how you do business. You start a little business, you make an investment, make money, take that money, invest in something else, make money, take that money, invest in something bigger. Yeah.
And then what about like the, you know, if you walk into Westside, I mean, there's a ton of interesting equipment. I mean, you know, like the fact that none of this stuff existed and you saw a need like that, like you were saying, that inverted leg curl, kind of like something like a frog would do.
Yeah.
Like, I mean,
MR19, yeah.
Like how, you know, I mean, was it something where, you know, there was a need and, or, you know, an idea, like how did the inspiration for all
it
that
could
start?
Have been, I could have invented things for football had I been in football. Because like I said, I got the track girl and another girl. And I was watching, I said, you know what? If they need to get these hips stronger and everything, what if they pulled themselves, you know, backwards? And man, it works. That thing. Whenever Rogue gets to make any things, you're gonna sell a lot of those. They work.
Is Rogue gonna make them?
Yeah, they're making. They got all the contracts and everything down there.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, they just have steel production. They couldn't get to steel.
Yeah. No, it's a fucking mess. Because I weld and fabricate and I work on trucks and it's part of like my my hobby is power athlete, we have about 5,000, it's about 5,200 square foot building, and then half is the gym, and then the other half is my shop where I weld and fabricate and I work on trucks.
Wow.
So I put diesel motors in big trucks and I got I've done bunch of crazy shit. So I'm when I heard about your Hellcat, I got excited because I have a 6.2 LS motor that I'm doing an LSA supercharger on in one of my trucks right now. So I'm in the process of messing with that thing. So, but I mean the steel. I mean, dude, what I used to be able to get like a sheet of 4x8, you know, quarter inch steel for. I mean, it's gone up fivefold in the last 2 years. It's actually insane. I mean, the point where I've been hoarding metal and it's like, man, to have to go out and actually production this stuff. And then the problem is the consumer doesn't know that because they don't know what metal prices are. So a machine that, you know, hey, that thing should cost X. Fuck, to go buy that machine now is 3X.
Mm.
There's a lot of steel in that machine. We were playing with it.
Yeah. Everything's gone bonkers.
Well, I mean, that would be definitely a fun machine to have. I wonder if they're going to like make one that's a little more, I guess you could say, space friendly, because that's a big fucking machine.
It is a big machine, but somebody like you needs a machine that big. We might be almost too long for that machine.
Oh, yeah. No, I squeezed in there and got in there.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
You got everything straight,
yeah.
Your legs.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it was fun. I mean, as we started doing it, I'm like, oh, this isn't that bad. And all I could think of was like, if we keep putting more weights on, this shit's going to get real ugly.
Yeah, it's a good one, though. I mean, how do I know this? Not by what we do, but, you know, a lot of baseball players and all kinds of different people, they all love it. Fighters love it. They love it. Everybody loves it.
So what do you think in terms of I mean, obviously you have a ton of templates and whatever, you know, for powerlifting, you know, with the sprinters, it's all different. I mean, does everybody kind of, you know, follow a West Side Influence program, but it's all kind of individually based?
Well, when you come here, there's so many injuries in sprinting. And that's what my book is, Prevention of Injuries, Strength Manual and Prevention of Injury. Well, how do you get hurt running? And so I talked to the high state coach. He came here for a while. I said, why do you get these injuries? He said, well, they're overuse injuries. I said to him, why do you overuse them? Why don't you do something else? Mm-hmm. And you were born running. An idiot, a chicken can run with his head chopped off. It don't take a genius. I've said a million times, now you were there. Now you might say, yeah, Lou, you're right or wrong. But I will guarantee you, if it wasn't for NFL, there'd be players in the NFL, it'd be the world record holder of 1,600 meters.
Yeah.
They'd outrun both. There's no way they wouldn't.
Yeah,
guys are like.
Yeah, we had a new 40-yard dash record at the combine this week.
Yeah,
4.21.
Yeah, 4.21, which is interesting because Deion Sanders allegedly ran faster than that. So, like, the story goes that, like, Deion, like, when they did, like, I mean, who knows? It's all these fucking legends.
Is Deion telling the story?
I'll tell you, man. Like, so the problem I have with some of this stuff, like, I don't know what the, like where they brought, like, fuck, how do I say this and not sound like a complete fucking asshole? I don't believe that the kids are training as hard today as they used to. So, like, we're seeing more stuff. So then is it the timing? Is it the technique? Is it just the advent of technology, which more app, you know,
track.
Like, I mean, is it track? Like, what is it? But I really don't believe that the kids are training. Cause I'll just tell you this, just looking at like the offensive linemen, when I played, everybody looked well put together. Like everybody's shirts filled, sleeves out. Like everybody looked pretty stacked. Like we were talking about, like Nebraska in 94, 95, 96. Like those dudes look like football players. See the guys today. Shit, they don't look like they do any curls. I'm like, give these guys some hammer curls. At least give them some fucking arms to fill out their jerseys. And I don't know why they've gotten away from this. I mean, everybody should do some classic bodybuilding just so you look good on Sunday. And, you know, pack a little muscle on. That shit's the best investment you can for injury, like we said. I mean, that's the fucking armor you need to be able to go out and survive this job.
Louis, I got a question for you. Do you feel there's a difference between injury prevention training and then not hurting your athletes in training?
Yeah, because they're going to get hurt in training because they ain't doing shit. Yeah, these coaches are afraid to hurt people. Just, you shouldn't even be a coach. You know, I know they make good money. I know some NFL coaches, you know, they make pretty good money. But I couldn't do that job. I'm not going to put you in my race car and have you drive 80 mile an hour instead of 180 mile an hour. I'm not going to do it. You're going to do it or you're not going to do it. Yeah. Yeah, they all got these gimmicks. I guess. Everybody's got a gimmick, and gimmicks are gimmicks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, what's the future of this thing? I mean, is it, are we seeing a regression? I mean, or is it just cyclical? I mean, does everything, like you said, does it kind of run like this?
I think that's what it is. And I think someone's got to start back, wipe it down, and teach the basics. You know, like I said, what you did with Josh down there that day, you never seen those things. That was nothing for you because you learned the basics. He's never even learned the basics. So you think he would come out with high state, but obviously no. They bring him down here, and I'm going like, you got to be kidding me. This, the last time I quit doing this, they brought, I don't know, it was four or five guys for, you know, try out for the combine. Three of them could not, three of them could not bench 300 pounds, and they couldn't box, 400 pounds. And these are all somebody online. And I go, I'm done with this. This, you know, I never seen anything like it. I'm going, how could this guy be that big in that week? And live to play football. Or that, or your opponent's not very strong.
Well, that's why you see guys like Aaron Donald who come out and running through these dudes because, I mean, that guy's pretty well put together. You can tell he trains. I mean, he's got the, you know, the appearance of somebody. Like, I could always tell, like, I can, without a shadow of a doubt, tell you whether or not a dude lifts weights. And I, you know, normally traps and shoulders and some of the other kind of intangibles that you only get from under a barbell. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's when somebody's like, oh, I lift weights. I'm like, whatever you're doing, you don't look like you lift weights. We must be lifting different weights.
Yeah.
And then you see a guy like that and they're over there. I mean, they can't fucking kiss his ass enough on TV. And it's just because the offensive linemen aren't training like they need to. I mean, I played with dudes that would have fucking killed that guy. And it was because there was just a different mentality. And I don't know, maybe it's social media. I don't know. I can't figure it out for the life of me. But I always thought that the weak link in our society was access to information. You know, like I was telling them that I was real fast when I was growing up, and then I grew a whole bunch, and I was real slow, and I couldn't figure it out. So I went to the library, and I checked out a book on speed running. And the only thing I remember was downhill running, like if you can run, do over speed. So I drove around looking for like a hill to run downhill. And I mean, but now, I mean, shit, how many people are going to the library? How many people are calling people asking, you know, showing up, you know, hat in hand, make me great.
And, like you get on the field.
You know, but like that's what that's where that mentorship process comes from and coming to learn. And I just think it's I just think too much access to information. It's almost overwhelming. I mean, think about how many systems there are and everybody's got, like you said, a gimmick and this. But at the end of the day, there is no fucking gimmick.
Yeah, they got a gimmick. But as I always say, where's the results? Where's the results? When I was a kid, Jerry Schottenstein, he multimillionaire, and the guy I worked for, he gave me a job at 12 as a bartender. And but for some reason they liked me, and Jerry'd show up on a job. Now he's a general contractor. You know, he did the concrete, the steel, you name it, did everything. So he wanted money. He'd want his draw. So Harold would come out there and have Jerry Sonstein come out, and then they'd take me with him. Maybe walking around all the time. I was a little kid. I don't know, they drugged me, but they did. And I heard him one day. Harold was wanting paid, and he goes. He looks around. He's got a big old coat on, big Jew, you know. At that coat, and he looks around and says, Harold, show me what you've done. That has never left my mind to this day. Show me what the fuck you've done. You run your mouth, what have you done? You know, everybody's got these, like you said, they got programs and this and that. I never even heard of these people. And they all got a program. They don't go to meets. They don't put it online. So, but I'll never forget that saying. I remember he said, show me what you've done. Like, well, where's the block? Where's the concrete? It's funny, it was stuck with me. That'd be 62 years. Mm-hmm. But it stuck with me. Because when people wanted to say something, said, show me what you've done. You in the top 10? You know, when PLUSA was out? Where's it at? Where's your name? Don't tell me you've done something, you've never done it and all this. And I don't know. I get a little disturbed of some things, but I just try to stay in my little hole.
Yeah.
I go to meet, and as soon as it's over, I'm out of there and back home, and that's where I want to be, back here and start training again. Get these guys going. And, you know, like a guy asked me one day down there, you know, they're never going to be the greatest. And he says, what do I expect? I said, progress. Just make progress. That's all I'm asking. If you don't make progress, I don't know why you're here. You know, just for what, the name and a t-shirt or something? I don't know. But you got to make progress. And if you don't make progress, you know how it is in sports. You're in a weird sport because ESPN, they'll badmouth you one day, they'll kiss your ass the next. I'm going like, I can't stand to watch it. Like Stephen A. Smith and these guys.
Well,
I don't give a damn.
It's because of the news cycle, man. Like the news cycle is about 7 days. So people's memories are so short. Their attention spans are so short that these guys have to be more polarizing every time you hear them. And that's why Stephen A. Smith acts the way he does. And like whether or not any of these guys believe any of this shit blows my mind. But it's the fact that we've just become so desensitized that it's usually the loudest, yappiest, biggest fucking load of bullshit is the thing that catches people's attention. Maybe. And now because there's so many different ways and different avenues in terms of projecting information, whether it be social media and phones and here, and you know, everybody's got this fucking Instagram page, or you got this. I mean, you got thousands of people vying for everybody's attention. So it's unfortunately, like you said, man, the one who yells the loudest tends the one that people tune in. That's what I think people have become used to, where it's not necessarily the person that's producing results for the last 5 or 6 decades. It's the person that's got the biggest gimmick or the best branding or the one that can yell the loudest or talk the most shit, which is funny because, I've never seen the level of shit talking and pettiness that I have in powerlifting and the lack of support. I mean, you would think that these dudes were like arguing about purses or it's fucking unbelievable. Like I said, like that dude benches, like I don't give a shit. Like there's Like the difference, but like, so geared powerlifting and raw powerlifting are two different sports. Like it just is. Like you can't equate them. And like the fact that you have people that like barely bench 225 in the local gym shitting on a dude benching 1322 in a fucking shirt. Like, why would you think there would be? Like it just blows my fucking mind. And maybe because I've lifted weights my whole life, so I know that even you could give me everything you want, every shirt, fucking monolift, a crane, and still not be able to do 1322 off of that. It just blows my fucking mind.
That's like insane. That's unbelievable. Do you see that guy? I think it's Israel, whatever, raw bench 804.
Yeah.
Is he a beast or what?
Yeah, I mean, what's he, 400 plus pounds?
Jesus Christ. Yeah. Like a bear.
Yeah. And like, and the thing I love is that these dudes come out of nowhere. Like the guy's been, like you said, he's like a bear. He's been training in a cage somewhere. And then it comes in and does like a fucking legit 800 pound bench. I mean, it's unreal.
People ask me which one's most impressive. And I said, I can't pick one over the other. They're both insane.
Yeah.
I never thought it'd be 800 pound bench press.
Yeah.
Roll. It's saying something.
Well, I mean, what's the biggest squat? Geared
right
squat
over 1300. Yeah, Brian Carroll did like 1303.5, whatever it is, the kilos. Yeah, and then he's done. You know, packed it in.
Well, I mean, what's Dave Hoff's still training, isn't he?
As far as I know, he's getting ready for WPO.
And he's, I mean, he's totaled over 3,000. I mean, he's
3,100. Yeah, he's so far ahead of everybody. Amazing. He's spatial, you know, just spatial. Spatial body, spatial leverage, and spatial brain.
Yeah, he's a big dude. I mean, yeah, I saw him come in and I was like a fucking Ram man.
He's thick.
Yeah. So what's the future for Westside Barbell?
I don't know. I'm hoping to get some lifters and make some more history.
So the mission never changes, huh?
Nope, never does. You know, you got to have resources to win races. And just trying to get some resources in here. Tom will tell you it's hard to get. You tell me one strong guys, they got guys benching 2.25 at 220. Tell you even, what are you doing even sitting this in? I guess they think highly of themselves. I don't know. My thing was always been education. And I was a terrible student for years, but now I realize, like I said, when it started to get bad, I had to pass what I know on, or why would I be here? The only difference between me and the Russians seemed like they retired quick for lifting, and then they became scientists. You know, they're scientists at 37 years old. Me, I went to 63. I didn't have time to write all those books and stuff until I really, started sat down and doing this. And I mean, I worked with over 70-foot shot putters. You know, worked with Butch Reynolds, Mo Robinson, Olympic gold medals, and 400. So a lot of people just all over the place, and I've only had a few. If I had a bunch of them, what if I had a bunch of them? Because that's how you learn. You learn from a group. You don't learn from one or two guys.
No. I mean, that makes total sense.
Yeah.
So if, in terms of the education stuff, I mean, obviously you write books, and you guys do courses. So if people want to get more information, Westside Barbell, easy right. enough to Google it. And
just go right to Westside Barbell and Tom Barrow will take care of you.
Awesome. You got anything else, Mr. McQuilkin?
No, sir. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Thank you.
For everything, yeah. The time, and all of you've done.
Yeah. Yeah, thanks.
Yeah, thanks for coming on, and thanks for tuning in to another episode of Power Athlete Radio.
Bye.
Hey there, Power Athlete Nation. Big shout out to all the heavy hitters who stuck around till the final whistle. If you've been soaking in the knowledge bombs and epic tales you've been dropping for free, here's your chance to be a game changer. Swing by klfi.com/powerathlete and toss a few bucks our way to keep the podcast fueled and firing on all cylinders. That's klfi.com/powerathlete. Your support makes a difference. See ya.